And hello everyone, welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Tim Phillips.
Hey, he's back!
It's been 3 months. It's good to be back.
I don't think it's been that long.
I was looking at the notes from the last show, it said May 12th.
All right, it's been that long. It's been okay, months. Well, welcome back. Okay, we barely noticed you. Okay. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new giant shark movie, The Meg. That is in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some recent news items from the past week, including Idris Elba. Is he going to be the next James Bond? The people taking bets seem to think so, but how likely is it that they are right? And then the Toronto International Film Festival has released its Midnight Madness lineup, and no zombies? Anyway, we'll talk about the films that are there. And then finally, The Fugitive is turning 25, and we'll talk about why the story of a man on the run trying to prove his innocence still resonates. But first, the changes to the Oscars. Now, usually it's winter time when we start talking about Oscars and controversy, but this week the Board of Governors announced that they were making some changes to the show format, and some pretty significant changes up to and not necessarily limited to. They're introducing a new film category, which is, I think its official title is Best Achievement in Popular Film. Which sounds like nothing, but this is a problem that the Academy keeps trying to solve. That's why they added 5 extra movies to Best Picture. It was this will allow room for, you know, your Dark Knights or your Skyfalls or your Inceptions and movies that may not necessarily make Best Picture, but that has not gone according to plan. And instead, we're going to try giving it an MTV Movie Award at the at the Oscars.
Like People's Choice Awards used to be, right?
Yeah. I think People's Choice Awards are still around. Perhaps not as popular as they once were, but anyway, your thoughts.
I think it kind of defeats the purpose of an award show to give it to the most popular show. you could have a debate whether award shows, you know, the importance of them, if there are too many award shows, should there even be award shows? It's so subjective when it comes to film and television. But I think it's pretty ridiculous to have a popular film category. It's just trying to bring in viewers, which I don't think it'll be too effective in doing that if the telecast is still going to be 3.5 hours long. They're talking about cutting it back, but it's still going to be the same Oscars, except with a popular film category. And they're talking about cutting into some of the technical awards, but I don't think that's going to save them that much time. I think there were some people who were like, have won Best Editor before and said, my speech only took like 10 seconds anyway.
You know? Those people get swept off the stage in like a matter of seconds because they know Sandra Bullock has, you know, 3 extra minutes of stuff to say or when, you know, when she wins.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, that's the kind of thing that kind of irks me. I mean, we can make the argument that, they're cutting out the legs from people who win Best Sound Design and Visual Effects. But from what I understand, there are members of the Board of Governors who represent the people who win those awards, or at least the unions from which those people work from. And, you know, so they seem to not have a problem with it. I mean, if I was a sound editor, I might have a problem with it because it's my chance to shine.
Right?
They might want to... You know, because this is like one of those things where it seems like there are a million solutions they could have tried before going with the popcorn Oscar. You know, things like having a recital of all the best song nominees and having like these tributes to films of the past and seating the people who win, like people who are up for Oscars. I mean, they fill the front rows with like all the celebrities, and I get that.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are years, Jack Nicholson doesn't go to the Oscars much anymore, but there are years where Jack Nicholson was just going for a night and he would just be
front,
there.
Yeah.
It's like, why don't you put all the nominees in the first row so then we can cut down on the minute we watch the guys from Avengers walk up to the stage to accept Best Sound Editing.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost nickel and diming, you know, the time, but, it, you know, there you can slim this thing down just by seating everyone properly.
Yeah, well, they have the celebrities in front, and often they're associated with a movie, like the more popular Best Picture nominees or whatever.
Yeah.
Then, like, the best foreign, the guy who won Best Director, might be the best director in the whole place, and he's from Iran or something. He has to walk, like, through the, walk through a tunnel, down some stairs, yeah, just to get to the front of the stage.
He's on the second Maisonie.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it seems so silly. And, I mean, even just philosophically, a couple of people on Twitter, I'll quote, Erin Ryan, who's with Crooked Media, she said there's already an Oscar for the best, for the most popular film. It's called Money.
Yeah, exactly.
And then Mark Harris said something that, you know, kind of shook me a bit. He said that, I'm paraphrasing, but he said it's funny in a year where you have Black Panther, a film that is stars predominantly African-Americans, directed by an African-American, in a year that is, to date, the biggest movie of the year in terms of box office revenue, and so a likely contender for the most popular movie of the year, that you would set up a separate but equal category in which this might be considered, so that thus avoiding, you know, having to give up a Best Picture slot to it, which is something a lot of people have talked about so far.
Yeah.
And it's also something people talked about for Wonder Woman, too.
Yeah. It's a very interesting argument. It might come down to how we criticize films and, you know, because Black Panther and Wonder Woman are both big blockbuster movies, basically, right? Whereas a movie like Get Out was nominated, won an Oscar, and it was a smaller movie that made you think a little bit more, you know? So it comes down to how are we judging what the best movie is? Is the best movie purely the best entertainment, or are we looking for some sort of deeper messages? And which there are in a lot of the blockbuster movies, but, you know, I think it comes back, whether it's right or wrong, to the critics or the people judging the movies looking at, like, if it was Get Out versus Black Panther, which movie would they pick?
Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking probably Get Out. But, you know, that's kind of how it goes. I don't know if there's anything nefarious at play from a racial or a gender standpoint that's stopping those movies from being nominated. It's more blockbuster popcorn movie versus deeper meaning movie. You know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah. But, you know, at the same time, Get Out was marketed and sold as a horror movie.
Right.
And it is a horror movie. It's just that it has a message versus something like, you know, Jason X, which the message is we're sending Jason Voorhees into space. Woo.
Yeah. Exactly.
but, I think what it has to do is, you know, when the Oscars So White thing happened a couple of years ago, I don't think anyone was saying, I could be wrong, I don't want to put words in people's mouth. Nobody's saying is like the Academy is racist, as in like we are not going to nominate Black performers or Black directors. What it is that there's a thinking afoot that people not necessarily assign as racist, but because people aren't open to different viewpoints, it's sort of racist by accident. So you're not really thinking about giving Straight Outta Compton, which is a musical biopic about NWA Oscar nominations. But if that was a musical biopic about the Beatles, it probably would have gotten 11 Oscars.
Right, yeah. That's
but because it's about a rap group from the late 80s, all Black, singing about Blank the Police, it's given sort of the short shrift. And that's not necessarily racist, but it shows a blind spot in the Academy that is accidentally racist.
Might be the content, too, because you're looking like Straight Outta Compton. You look at what NWA's albums were about. Like, they were groundbreaking, but they're in your face, you know, scandalous type records in a lot of cases.
But that's a matter of attitude,
you know. Whereas like Ray won the Best Actor for Jamie Foxx, so that's a biopic that won the best actor Oscar. So I don't know, I don't think I think a lot of it has to do more with the content, and maybe, you know, the age of the people who are nominating and voting on the Oscars. So the age, it's more age dependent, where, you know, younger people would be more in tune to to content that may be way more offensive to people who are 65 plus who are voting on the Oscars as well.
Right. It's there's a double standard at play because, you know, movies like Raiders of the Lost Ark was Best Picture nominated. Mm-hmm. E.T. was. Star Wars was.
Yeah.
The Fugitive was.
Yeah. Yeah.
25 years ago, The Fugitive was a Best Picture nominee, yeah. And no one felt they had to, you know, we like The Fugitive and all, but, you know, there's just so many good movies. No, they made room out of 5 movies for The Fugitive, yeah. Which is a lot of fun, as we'll talk about, right. But I'm not necessarily sure if we go back and look at 1993, it was one of the five best yeah. movies of the year. It's an attitude thing, because I think the Academy's caught between wanting to appear that they are erudite by choosing the best movies, mm-hmm. which aren't always necessarily the ones that make the most money, yeah. and the fact that when people go to the movies now, they're going to the big tent poles, your Mission Impossibles, yeah. your Black Panthers, your right. You know, Deadpools, what have you.
Yeah, and I think if we go back in time, the perfect example of a movie from African-American filmmaker that was totally snubbed was Do the Right Thing in 1989. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Wasn't even nominated. Mm-hmm. And that was such a great movie if you look from just like a critical aspect of mm-hmm. like story, character, everything like that. And for whatever reason, maybe because it's very controversial, the ending was controversial. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure the reasoning, but it wasn't even nominated. So I can see something like that where it kind of fits into the categories of what, you know, what the Academy considers a great movie, you mm-hmm. know, great acting, great story development. And it wasn't even nominated. So that's where you see, and that's when, you know, maybe like a movie like, was it Selma, where the director wasn't nominated or something
yeah.
like that?
Yeah.
That's when you can yeah. see like, okay, this is a movie that fits into the framework of what a Best Picture Oscar could be, but something's yeah. at play here where this person wasn't nominated,
right.
you know.
Yeah. And you can draw a straight line from Do the Right Thing to Boys in the Hood, which came out a couple of years later, and that got nominated for an Oscar, and John Singleton became the first black director nominated for an Oscar.
Right.
One of only 4 that have been nominated since.
Yeah.
But... Yeah, I think it's just, you know, it's a cultural shift. And I think to sort of wrap this up, I think it was Polygon that posted a list of other Oscars they should be giving out before most popular movie, and among yeah. them were like stunt coordinator. Like if you want to honor something like Mission Impossible,
yeah.
that's all stunt work.
Right. Exactly.
That's all the guys like training Tom Cruise to leap out of a high altitude airplane.
Yeah.
Or voice acting. Mm-hmm. You know, that gets you animated films, that gets you things like Scarlett Johansson and Her, yeah. which a lot of people said was maybe worthy of a Best Supporting Actress nomination, yeah. even though she's not in it. But c'est la vie. Speaking of black people breaking down barriers, they're talking about Idris Elba as potentially the next James Bond. Mm-hmm. The London odds makers, because apparently you bet on these things in England.
they bet on everything in England, right?
Apparently. they're laying that he is likely the most likely candidate. This came from Anton Fuqua, who I'm not sure how he ended up in a conversation with one of the Bond producers, but he quoted her as saying that she sees a point in the not-too-distant future where the, James Bond will be black, and because Idris Elba has long been a candidate mm-hmm. For James Bond, even going back before Spectre as Daniel Craig's successor, a lot of people are looking at him now. But I tend to think when it comes to these things, it's always someone we don't expect. And, you know, going back to... I don't know if it was 2004, 2005, when Daniel Craig was revealed as the next James Bond.
Right.
I'm not sure how many people were saying, I bet I'm putting all my money on Daniel Craig.
Right, because he had a different kind of look.
Yeah.
Right? For a while, they all kind of looked the same. It's like Pierce Brosnan,
yep.
Timothy Dalton. They all were like these dark-haired British
yeah.
men.
Very, like, yeah, yeah. very etiquette-friendly. And, you know, yeah. and Daniel Craig goes back to, like, sort of the original Connery Bond,
mm-hmm.
down and dirty, rough and tumble. And he was blonde, and that was yeah. kind of a mark
oh,
against
oh,
him.
Oh, wow.
yeah, that he was a blonde James Bond.
How can we have a blonde James Bond?
It was scandalous. so many monocles were dropped in teacups. It was... But, yeah. You know, I think I as much as I would dig Idris Elba as James Bond, I think he's 45. I'm not sure. And Daniel Craig turns 50 this year, so I'm not sure if they wanted to choose Idris.
I think the funny thing with Idris Elba is he's not even, it's not even clear that he wants the role.
Yeah.
This has been a rumor for 5 years, and yeah. It's never been discussed that he's been offered the role or he wants it or anything like that. And yet it's been discussed. Yeah. So it's like, it's funny that everyone's like, he should be the next James Bond. And he hasn't even commented on it, basically. So.
He said he's like, oh, it's kind of an honor to be considered.
Yeah.
Like, it's an honor just to be nominated. But I think he doesn't take it seriously, probably because you're right. He's there's no talks. It's like one of those rumors around the office, around the water cooler. Oh, so-and-so is going to be promoted to the manager. And then an entirely different person is brought in, and everyone's like, huh, didn't see that coming. Because you were talking about Idris Elba being James Bond the whole time. You didn't see other people sneaking around. Because the odds makers also have money on Daniel Kaluuya from Get Out.
Okay.
as a potential Bond, and as well as John Boyega, who people know from the new Star Wars series. And I think of the three, I wouldn't mind seeing Daniel Kaluuya. I think, you know, he's probably just well-known enough, but still kind of under the radar, that if they were to elevate him to a role like that, it would catch people by surprise, and I think it would let him do some interesting things.
Yeah, that'd be cool to do something, because then he doesn't... Like, Idris Elba makes a lot of sense to me, because he would be, like, you know, he's got a lot of experience, he has a lot of presence about him.
Yes,
and
he does.
Stuff. I think it'd be interesting to have him in the role, but to go and, to go with somebody else, I'd be completely, Daniel Kaluuya, to go with, am I saying his name right?
Yeah.
Okay. To go with him, that would be really interesting, because he seems a lot younger to me, right? So to go with a younger James Bond, because I think James Bond, it's in this category now where there's, it's supposed to be like 40, 45, 50, sort of this distinguished older man kind of thing.
Yeah, they want to get 4 or 5 movies out of guy, like much the same way as they've gotten 4 or 5 movies out of Daniel Craig, or they will by the time the next movie comes out next year.
I think Idris Elba would be, actually, I think that'd be a really good choice. I'm not the biggest James Bond fan,
because
I kind of find that it's often homogeneous in a lot of ways, whether the race of James Bond or it's always with the gadgets and stuff, which is cool, but, you know, it'd be nice to shake it up a little bit.
Well, you know, I guess the other way to shake it up would be to have Jane Bond, but I feel like we've already got that. You know, you were here last year when we reviewed Atomic Blonde.
Oh, yeah.
Which felt like Jane Bond to me.
That's what they're
hard drinking, hard living.
Yeah. Spy.
Yeah, sex for breakfast, death for lunch. It was, you know, and took place during the Cold War. So I figure that's kind of checked off. But
right.
That's kind of the only...
Yeah, and I guess they kind of wanted a franchise for that, and I'm not sure if they will have. It was kind of popular, but it wasn't... Yeah. I don't think it was the blockbuster they wanted.
It wasn't even... Yeah, it wasn't the... I think they thought it was going to be the female John Wick, and I don't think they... I don't think the reaction... they didn't get the reaction they hoped it would that John Wick got, but
it'd be cool to to see a female James Bond where they just totally do the James Bond but just flip it upside down. So instead of the Bond girl, it's the Bond boy or
Bond
something.
Boy, yeah,
exactly.
That'd
be pretty interesting. Yeah, that'd be a cool film.
Speaking of cool films, TIFF is. We talked last week about the specials and the galas that TIFF has released. Last week they released the list of docs, and we'll touch on that because, you know, a lot of the usual suspects. Michael Moore's bringing his new film, which is about the Trump era in America politics. Earl Morris is bringing his film American Dharma, which is about Steve Bannon, also with American politics. And then Werner Herzog has his documentary, which is about Mikhail Gorbachev, meeting Gorbachev.
Okay.
So, you know, the usual suspects in the doc categories. What's a bit more interesting is Midnight Madness, which is literally the show at midnight. It's genre films. The two biggest ones, two really named ones, are The Predator, the Shane Black revival of Predator, the Predator franchise, and Halloween, the David Gordon Green reboot retcon of Halloween. starring Jamie Lee Curtis and actually the original Michael Myers, Nick Castle, I think his name is.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Still has the creepy movements after all these years, then?
It might even be more creepier depending on his mobility. It's...
But, Mike Myers has a walker in this one.
It wasn't in the trailer, but you know, there may be some like scenes after he like chases Jamie Lee Curtis for a while. It's like I gotta sit down. I gotta just let me put my knife down.
Just run in a zigzag pattern away from him. You're okay.
Somebody get my oxygen. I need my oxygen before I continue this chase.
He's not. He's not in the mental hospital anymore. He's in the old folks' home. That comes out.
He's in the old folks' ward of the mental hospital. Exactly. He's playing, you know, Pinochle and. I don't think that's the movie we're going to get, which is a shame.
No, that'd be good. That'd be good for Midnight Madness, too. You need the humor with it, right? So,
yeah, you do need the humor because I feel like those are like the best ones, like the winking and the nodding and the kind of jokey ones because, you know, it's after midnight and you're up late and, you know, maybe a little sleep deprived, so a little punchy anyway. But
yeah, the cult movies, ones that are just really quirky. Those are...
Yeah, so there are a couple of interesting ones. The guy that made Duke of Burgundy has a new film called Fabric. There's sadly, and IndieWire made a case of this, there was only one film directed by a woman, Emma Tammy, who's a documentary maker. It's she made a movie called The Wind, which is about the frontier, and it's the guy who programs Midnight Madness says it has good scares and good drama. Mm-hmm. the guy who made Wormwood, Road of the Dead, an Australian director named Kaya Roche Turner, has one called Necrotonic, which is about magical beings chasing demons through the internet, and Monica Bellucci is their queen. That sounds like the winner. But there are no zombies this year. No zombie movies.
They said it's too mainstream now.
It's too mainstream.
Yeah, and it has become that way. It's kind of the way vampires were about 10 years ago. It became too mainstream, and now it's...
My question
zombies.
Is, it wasn't mainstream last year or the year before that or the year before that? Because... And I wouldn't make a complete argument it's mainstream. The Netflix released a zombie movie earlier this year called Cargo, mm-hmm. which is a zombie movie with a lot of heart. Mm-hmm. It is like you cry at the end. It is so touching and beautiful. Mm-hmm. And you don't usually walk out of a zombie movie or sit on your couch and turn off the zombie movie and reach for a Kleenex. But you did. But, you know, years ago they had like the latest Romero Dead movies, like Survival of the Dead and Diary of the Dead, which was like found footage. And it's like, it was like Romero was making those films because people gave him money to make zombie films. Mm-hmm. Like there was no real heart in it. Like if you go, like not when you watch Dawn of the Dead or Day of the Dead.
Right.
It's just, you know, he's kind of, or even Land of the Dead. Land of the Dead still has some heart in it. Those movies I felt had no heart in them.
And that's the thing with the Midnight Madness, right? Like the headlines, Predator and Halloween.
Yeah.
And you think even no matter how good they are, if they have original cast members, it's just a reboot of a reboot of a reboot, you know? Where what you're talking about are movies that are probably more personal to the filmmakers and stuff, you know? And those are the ones that, and hopefully in this collection that they have this year, there are films like that. I imagine there are. They just want to get people in with these titles that everyone knows.
Right.
But yeah, it's just, those are the ones that'll stick with you. And it doesn't matter what genre, right? It could be zombie, could be vampire. That's been done a million times. But if it's got that heart and that personal touch, that's something I'd want to see. And most people will end up wanting to see.
Right.
It's kind of too bad there's only one female director as well. You're thinking with
all the
films are showing Midnight Madness that there would be more female directors or more just broader range.
Because, you know, the thing about the Midnight Madness films is the big name films like your Predator and your Halloween or I can't remember what, can't think of off the top of my head what was in recent years, but the big name films with the big stars and the reboots and all that, those aren't the great Midnight Madness movies. Mm-hmm. The great Midnight Madness movies are the ones like The Loved Ones, which was one I saw almost 10 years ago from Australia. Mm-hmm. But it is so over the top, and so like cringy and scary, and the, mm-hmm. the main actress in it is amazing. Mm-hmm. Something like Bitch Slap, which is exactly what it sounds like. It is pure TNA cornball. Yeah. Just catfighting women for 90 minutes, and it has so much zest in it. It's like got enough energy for three movies, yeah. even though it's completely objectifying it and then sort of yeah. terrible from a feminist perspective.
Yeah, you wonder when you start going through some of these Midnight Madness titles as we go on and we start talking. Like, it's already been brought up, only one female director, yeah. but like the content. A lot of what makes midnight movies are like TNA or
yeah.
graphic violence, or yeah. there's stereotypes plenty in these films. It's just like, how do you? But that's interesting of people finding new ways to tell those types of stories,
sure.
right?
Yeah,
but yeah, I could see if you looked at some of these films in that. Frame of mind, you might be like, oh my god, how could they make a movie about catfighting women in a prison? How could they do that, right?
I mean there's also like the last year, the what is it called, the Brawl in Cell 99 was the big one, and that's, you know, that's a very serious film, but, you know, very well done too. So, you know, there are things that sort of like catch you off guard that you don't expect. But I yeah. think that if you're going to Midnight Madness, those are the ones you want to look for, because yeah. you can see Halloween in a couple of months when
exactly,
it's in theaters
yeah.
anyway. So
yeah.
Speaking of things you can watch on right now, it's 25 years since The Fugitive came out. You know, I'm almost kind of getting sick of these, like every week we kind of have like
years.
A, yeah,
20
like,
years.
This movie you love is old. but it, I was struck by this Atlantic think piece where I was like talking about how The Fugitive is a very adult action movie, in that it's not about, you know, people hanging off airplanes and gregarious stunts like that.
Just hanging
it's,
off a train or something.
leaping off a bus about to get hit by a train. But
yeah,
I mean, that's
right. Yeah.
That's like the biggest action sequence in that.
Yeah.
And a lot of it's just based on, you know, the cat and mouse game, and, you know, mm-hmm. and Richard Kimball trying to evade detection, mm-hmm. trying to evade Tommy Lee Jones as Sam Gerard. Just by, you know, walking around in the St. Patrick's Day parade, it's yeah. it's really clever in that way, where it's a very tense film, but, you know, there's the tension is kind of constant because you're worried about him getting caught, as because you know he's innocent, you know he's on a mission, mm-hmm. And everyone else thinks he's guilty, but, you know, there's no halo jump.
Right.
You know, there's no yeah. Richard Kimball, you must, you know, drop from 30,000 feet to get into this segment to find the one-armed man and yeah. that kind of thing.
And he still did his own stunts. They said
he
that.
Did, yeah.
Didn't they say he tore a ligament or something? Or
he did.
And he did the rest of the movie with a limp, basically.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Commitment.
Harrison
commitment.
Ford, yeah.
Yeah. yeah. I was reading the a slash film piece, and it's like somebody was writing like The Fugitive was the last time Harrison Ford took a role seriously, and I'm not sure I'd go that far, mm-hmm. but because, you know, there are times where you see him acting, and I was thinking about Crossing Over, which is a terrible movie, but I don't think he's phoning it in that one, or something like Cowboys and Aliens, where he's like talking like Wilford Brimley. He's not phoning it in. It's a terrible performance, but he's not phoning it in.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's fascinating to talk about, you know, at what point did Harrison Ford stop caring?
I think it's well, he's always had that, you know, it's that confidence, right? So
yeah.
it's hard to, it depends on the quality of the movie to say whether he's caring or not. Like somebody like Clint Eastwood's the same thing. It's like,
sure.
is he caring or not in this movie? It depends how good the movie is. And it was interesting in the article when they're talking about The Fugitive and saying how both Harrison Ford and Tommy Lee Jones were thinking this could be like the end of their career, and
yeah.
this movie is just going to be this horrible wannabe blockbuster movie that was just going to fail. And,
yeah.
And but then they took it seriously, and
yeah.
it really paid off. And I was surprised too about when they're talking about the amount of improvising by Tommy Lee Jones in the film, because we often think that people are improvising, these actors, because he seems so clever, but often it is scripted. Like
yeah.
they talk about like Bill Murray movies, always improvising. No, it's all scripted a lot of the time. But Tommy Lee Jones improvised a lot of those lines, or the one "Think me up a cup of coffee and a donut with sprinkles on it." Like, he made up that line. That's really cool.
Tommy Lee Jones isn't well known for his improvisation skills, because there's a lot of that in Men in Black too. And I remember listening to the commentary on Men in Black. And Barry Sonnenfeld said that there was the scene where he meets Will Smith for the first time. There's more exposition, where he comes in and Will Smith tells him that an alien told him that the world's going to end. And there was apparently a whole exposition dump after that. But instead of reading all that off, Tommy Lee Jones just says, "Did he say when?" It works of his delivery, it's the last thing you expect someone to say. But speaking of blockbuster wannabes, we have to get into our review of the week, which is The Meg. To warm us up, we're just going to play a track here from another shark movie, almost 20 years old. And I hate to say it, but I think this shark movie was better than the one we're about to review. Anyway, you're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Be thy name, killers water beast, swallowing the flames. They switch my DNA, drip me to Cool J. I can't fight the feeling, I'm forced to kill prey. To survive an attack, there's only one way. Battle to the death, that's how sharks play. Weapons left behind, we dueling with the mind. You blind, crippled, and crazy, you're real easy to find. Struggling to float with hemorrhages in your throat. Getting the lap dance when I smash through your boat. Eat your whole fam, nothing left but a right hand. Clinging to a rail, escape attempts fail. Make it home, tear the flesh off your bone. Walking in undercurrents is a dangerous zone. I'm talking death out of moment's notice. You wasn't focused, me and my crew strike like some underwater locusts. Deep as blue as my hand is like a shark's fin. Deep as blue as my hand is like a shark's fin. Deep as blue as my hand is like a shark's fin. Deep as blue as my hand.
What's that?
A monster outside.
What you people discovered is bigger than we ever thought possible.
How big is that thing?
It was the largest shark that ever existed.
A living fossil.
Thought to have been extinct for over 2 million years.
Wrong.
Megalodon.
He's kidding, right?
And that was a clip from The Meg. It is the new film from John Turteltaub, and it stars Jason Statham, Bing Bing Lee, Cliff Curtis, Winston Chow, Ruby Rose, Paige Kennedy, and Rainn Wilson. And no, he's not kidding. this movie makes me sad. Because, you know, I hate those Sharknado movies. They're advertising the new one. I don't believe in the philosophy of, like, we can make a movie purposefully so bad it's good. I feel like that philosophy is incorrect, because real movies like The Room that are so bad they're good, people put their heart and their souls into making them.
Mm-hmm.
And so you feel the effort, which makes you appreciate just how much they failed and how you want to reward them in some way, even if it's not saying that that is a great movie. Mm-hmm. So you say, they tried their best and delivered something entertaining. And The Meg is not one of those movies. Mm-hmm. It's so tepid. I feel like it's so tepid.
Mm-hmm.
It feels, it feels like.
I found with it, I might have liked it a little more than you, but I found with it that, I don't know if it's a really good philosophy to say, I'm going to make something so bad it's good. Like, that's probably not a good mindset to have.
Yeah.
But if you are going to go in that direction, then just go full out, full bore in that direction.
Right.
And I felt like in this movie, there was a lot, my main criticism was there was a lot of, like, just, there were some serious moments. They're trying to get really serious with the relationship with the woman and her father and all this stuff. And it just seemed like it's really slowed down the pace. Because when it first started and you first see like Rainn Wilson, okay, here's Dwight from The Office coming on.
Yeah,
and it's pretty hilarious that he's like this billionaire scientist or whatever he was. Coming on and calling the shots, and then, you know, oh, we have to get Jason Statham here. He's our only hope. It's like going in the right direction for something that could be just fun and wild.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just felt like the pacing, it slowed down in certain points where it should have just like cut the fat. And that was something in a different type of movie, actually, like when I was reading the article about The Fugitive, which we discussed earlier, an adult thriller, but they cut the fat in a lot. They said, okay, there was a romance scene. There was a scene where he goes and has a coffee or something.
Yeah.
They just cut that out.
Yeah.
Just went straight to he's on the run the whole way. And I felt like they did have a lot of action with the shark, which I liked. And I like Jason Statham. He's really guilty pleasure for me, I guess, because he's just so wild, you know? Like, I think Crank's one of the best movies ever because it's just so wild, right?
He's the only person who could have starred in that.
Yeah, exactly. So it would, I liked it more than you. I liked some of the action, but it just felt like they should have just went full out on it, just full throttle.
Yeah.
You know?
That was my thought because it starts with a prologue of Jason Statham is some kind of deep water rescuer. It's not an implied that he's military or what his background is, but you know, he's rescuing, him and his team are rescuing people off a sub. He has to abandon two of his team members in order to save everyone else. And so there's this thing where he's, you know, not certain about wanting to get back in the water, but he gets back in the water right away. So it's like, why are you including this bit? Just start the movie with Rainn Wilson arriving. They find, you know, the secret lair. And the people on the sub get lost. Who are you going to call? Jason Statham. He's drunk on a beach in Thailand somewhere. That's all you need to know.
Yeah.
Get him on the boat and let him do his Jason Statham thing.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I feel like the direction this should have went in is like all the scientists are like a little bit wacky, but Jason Statham is the straight man, because that's almost the tone he plays in The Italian Job. Everyone's always been, you know, sniping back and forth at each other. And, and Jason Statham's like, all right, everybody, we're just going to do this thing. And
that was a good Jason Statham there.
It was, I've been working on it.
Yeah.
But that's how you use Jason Statham is that he plays it straight, even though, again, in Crank, everything around Crank is just completely madcap and zany and out there and over the top, and he's just playing it straight.
Yeah.
I don't need to have him like have profound conversations with Cliff Curtis about like, can you really do this? Can you really like get back into a, I can do this, Cliff Curtis. it's just no, I don't need to Jason Statham to, you know, to tempt me with a nuanced portrayal of PTSD. That's not what it's a giant shark movie. I don't need that. I just need Jason Statham versus a giant shark.
Yeah, that's what we needed. Yeah. Yeah. And then it ends up on the beach there, which is interesting, which I guess leads to like Jaws comparison. But with Jaws, there's this whole thing like it's a serious story, really. That's the thing that I think people might miss, you know, younger generations who think Jaws is just an action movie. That was a serious movie.
It's a thriller.
Yeah, it's about like choices that the police officer is going to make. Mayor, should we shut down this beach or should we keep it open? We need the money for the town. This town goes under. This is our main source of our economy here. Or do we shut it down for safety, you know? Where something like this should just be like, I don't know, like Sharknado. Just go for it.
But it's
know?
A
just,
monster movie.
Yeah.
Because we're blatantly saying the shark is a monster. The great white shark in Jaws. It's you know, it's actually Peter Benchley was inspired by a real life story about a shark in off New Jersey, which was not as big as the shark in Jaws, but you know, so it's still rather believable that there's such a thing as a big great white shark.
Mm-hmm.
We don't think that there are any megalodons around. Probably would have run into one by now.
Yeah.
But so you're treating it purely as a monster.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we're having conversations of like, well, it's kind of like the last one, and we didn't know it was out there. Shouldn't we be, like, trying to save it? Or, you know, things like that. No, it's a monster. What do you do with monsters? It's, it's, it seems so, you know, it takes itself too serious. And I think this is a top-down thing, because John Turteltaub, people probably are most familiar with his National Treasure movies, which are so earnest. Which is, like, you know, it's about Nicolas Cage, like, this is about the philosophy of America. This is an impression day. This is about the philosophy of America, guys. And it's. And I also looked up his IMDb because I wanted to re-familiarize myself what he did. This is a guy who did While You Were Sleeping and Phenomenon, which is like John Travolta gets superpowers.
Right.
And Three Ninjas is also one of his. So I think this film is also rated PG-13, which I think is a big problem because there's no gore, and I think this needed gore.
Yeah.
Because going
there's
back
a couple
to,
moments, yeah, and those are like most of the fun moments.
Yeah.
Like when they blow up the whale and it ends up on the guy's face, you know?
Right.
You need more stuff like that.
Yes. That was the film like reaching its potentials. That's like one of the peaks. If we were to make like a through line of this film, whether or not it reaches potential, that'd be one of the peaks.
Yeah, exactly.
But when you talk about Jaws, you know, it's a thriller. So that's why, you know, there's not a lot of gore in Jaws. You know, there's a couple of severed limbs in places. Yeah. But,
because it's all building up that tension.
It's all building up the tension.
Which the Meg doesn't have the gore, but it's not really building up the tension either.
Yeah, it doesn't have the tension either because, you know, the shark isn't real. And, you know, there's no such thing as, well, there was such a thing as a megalodon, but not anymore. Mm-hmm. So it needed to be a little more free. It didn't need to take itself so seriously. And I think the reason why Turteltaub was brought in, he's used to doing these big movies, and used to like managing like I guess the effects load and the logistics of something like this. But he doesn't have the I think the sort of grindhouse filter that I think he needed. Like something like the two movies I was thinking about. One is, as we played at the music from the movie, Deep Blue Sea, which has the audacity to have a shark jump out of the water and eat Samuel L. Jackson, spoiler alert, right in the middle as he's giving like an inspirational, rousing leadership speech about how they have to, you know, come together to defeat the genetically engineered sharks. And then another one, which people may not be as aware of and maybe not haven't seen, is Deep Rising, which is the movie Stephen Sommers did before he did The Mummy, which is just this smart-ass film in a cruise ship, in an abandoned cruise ship, and it stars Treat Williams, and they're like fighting like a squid, or some sort of monster that's inside the ship, it's got, you know, so many zingers and one-liners, but it's like over the top and it's gory and it's so much fun. That's what this needed to be.
Right.
I didn't need to have, as you said, the family dynamic. Although the kid was cute.
The kid was cute.
I give the kid points for being cute.
The cute dog in it too.
The cute dog, who of course survives. You know,
I would say there's some funny moments in it.
Sure.
And it's some good action. But if you're expecting just like wall-to-wall crazy action, you're going to be disappointed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, that's not even just crazy action, just like momentum. Because you're right, there's so much fat on this. Like there's like the kid playing like matchmaker with her mom and Jason Statham. And I almost like those scenes between the little girl and Jason Statham. I think Jason Statham is kind of like his own kindergarten cop kind of thing where he's interacting with kids.
Yeah.
Because I think that would play good against him. That's some
with the eyebrows. Yeah.
Yeah. That's some unsolicited career advice for Jason Statham. But you know, I didn't need probably half these characters. I didn't need them all to like. There's one guy who, well, let's say he's big, and he falls in the water twice before he's eaten. And it's like, you know what? I don't need him fall in the water twice. Once is enough. Gets eaten, and it just seems like they're so gun shy about you know making these characters, you know, snacks for the shark. And that's the thing about Deep Blue Sea. It's like, it doesn't care. We'll eat Samuel L. Jackson. Sure. Saffron Burroughs has this like wonderful sort of self-sacrificing moment in the end. She doesn't survive. All Thomas Jane and LL Cool J, just them, floating on the wreck of the, of that research station at the end.
Well, that's the funny thing. Funny thing with the Meg, like their marketing.
Yeah.
They had a really cool marketing campaign where it had pictures of people with their calorie content and their fat, just like you're buying them at the grocery store, but for the sharks. And I thought, that's pretty cool. They'd have like athletic guy, then there's this chubby guy, and he's got obviously more calories, more fat.
Yeah.
And so you think, there'd be more snacks for the shark.
It's, you know, and that's the thing. When it actually goes into, like, waters with people in it, like, it goes near that, like, tourist beach, and you see, like, the guys, like the frat guys on the raft who are like catcalling to the women and on the next raft over, or the weirdos and those little hamster balls on top. And it, the scene is like perfectly set up for like, you want to see these people get eaten because they're ridiculous. And that's just the way these things go. And then the shark comes up and it's like, there's also the kid. I don't know if it was an explicit reference back to Jaws, but he's he goes up to his mom and he's like, can I go in the water? And she's like, no. And then it seems like an almost deliberate callback to the Kentner boy in Jaws.
Yeah.
And he's like, I want to go in. I want to go in. I want to go in. I was like, this kid better get eaten. This kid,
this kid better get eaten.
And then
that's like, oh wow, this could have gotten really dark. Adam, if you directed this movie, man, you wouldn't have a problem with, like, poor box office. It'd be, like, the controversy. Kids eating left and right? What?
Well, this specific kid, I don't want all kids eating, but, you know, when you're on the, when you've got a popsicle in your mouth and you're just going up to your mom, I want to go in, I want to go in, I want to go in. And it's like, no, you die now.
It's just a setup in so many action movies that the kid's not going to get it. He's going to come back. So, oh, the kid's all right. That's just how it is. Yeah, it gets a bit ridiculous.
But, you know,
I'd like to see your movie. It'd be very interesting. Director's cut of the Meg.
Yeah, we were talking about Midnight's Madness movie. This seems like it should be a Midnight's Madness movie. And it's not being released in, like, February. It's not being released in December for, like, Oscar consideration. It's being released in the dog days of August. Yeah. And I can't imagine that was an indeliberate choice. Mm-hmm. So it's a story about... And I would like to say that maybe they were playing it cool because, of course, one of the fallouts of Jaws was the mass vilifying of sharks as man-eaters and as killers, mm-hmm. which is incredibly incorrect and has resulted in more than a few sharks being slaughtered for that reason. Mm-hmm. But again, it's a 75-foot shark. It's a monster movie. And, you know, nobody goes to, I don't know, like a... them, like a giant bug movie. Like nobody, when Starship Troopers came out and said, like, nobody's gonna, you know, go out there and start like spraying anthills, every anthill they find with Raid because they're scared that these bugs will evolve into like world killing pests. So it just seems like this was a misfire all around. But I don't know, have I persuaded you
to hate it more? I don't know. I think it's just one of those. It's just like so many films are kind of like this in a way, that are released. It's just, okay, we've got the action. We've got figured out, okay, there's going to be this monster, whatever, the action. And then they don't go all the way, right?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they wanted this to be PG-13. I don't know if they wanted it for the Chinese market. Was that what they're trying to do? I don't know.
It like, could be because, as we talked about last week, the Chinese are weird with some of their censorship things, and A Wrinkle in Time, you can't release A Wrinkle in Time because time travel is a taboo in China. But so you could be right, and I think there was a Chinese company that was a co-financier of this.
Yeah,
and of course Bing Bing Li is a well-known Chinese actress. I liked her. I thought she was provided nice sort of counterbalance to Statham's machismo, and it never made her a damsel in distress. You know, she was a very proactive character, and certainly uses her better here than in Transformers: Age of Extinction, where she's just yelling at Stanley Tucci for half an hour.
Yeah, this was cool. This was a good opportunity for her, and
mm-hmm.
I think overall, it's really at times really entertaining movie, but mm-hmm. then at times, yeah, it's just like they could have cut the fat, but
mm-hmm.
how
mm-hmm.
long was the movie again? It was like,
it's almost 2 hours.
Yeah, it probably could have been like 90 minutes or something. Just
it should have been 90 minutes.
Yeah.
It should have been. It seemed like a really good opportunity. And Candace was very excited. Candace was sorry she couldn't be here to review this.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently her cottage is more important. But I kid. But, I was excited about this. I was looking forward to this. And just, yeah, you're right. It came off the meat grinder. It came out of the studio machine. You know, it was probably some sort of mandate. It had to be PG-13 because they spent so much money. And China, obviously, has more influence than I think we'd like to admit when they're co-financing things.
Mm-hmm.
That it probably couldn't have too much in the way of gore or...
Yeah, it's a huge market there, right?
But it just seems like... It seems like it lost a real opportunity. We were talking about this during the break. I saw Slender Man the same day. Not the actual Slender Man, but the movie about Slender Man called Slender Man. And that was also a missed opportunity. Because, like the Meg, it felt like to me the people making that movie didn't understand what Slender Man was and what he represented and what people have invested in Slender Man. And I don't just mean the case of the two young girls in Wisconsin who stabbed their friend in honor of Slender Man. I mean people who are able to enjoy the dark things and not allow it to push them to do real life tragedies. But that was another movie where people didn't understand the monster and couldn't deliver on the promise, and it felt like, yeah, there was this real life tragedy around Slender Man, and the movie was maybe an opportunity to recontextualize that a bit. And that's so weird, an average Slender Man advertisement just popped up. But it missed because it fundamentally didn't understand the material. And I think that it's the same thing with the Meg. They
mm-hmm.
maybe there were too many cooks in the kitchen. Maybe John Turteltaub was the wrong guy to direct it, although he cast Jason Statham, and I was mm-hmm. like, yes, Jason Statham in a giant shark movie, that makes sense
mm-hmm.
in a weird way. But it just for me it was 2 hours of disappointment.
Well, it's too bad. it wasn't quite what as bad for got? Me. I didn't mind it, maybe because I had some popcorn with me. And next time get snacks. That's why they call them popcorn movies, Adam. If you had some popcorn, it would have been a lot better.
You know what, that makes as much sense as anything in the Meg.
Yeah. They should mandate that you have popcorn before you go in.
They should just hand it out. Yeah, exactly. It's like you going into this movie without popcorn. I don't know. It'll absorb the disappointment. You could be right. I could be taking it too seriously. I will accept that. But I mean, just as someone who is excited about this movie, and maybe yeah. that's just me. You know.
No, I can see that totally, because it is, mediocre. Probably the best word you can give for it.
Yeah.
So, like, for me, it had some moments that made me laugh and some good moments. But overall, yeah, it really was slowed down with a bunch of extraneous stuff, and it wasn't enough. Yeah, brutality to it, I guess.
Yeah.
There wasn't enough, because those couple moments where it was violent, it's like, wow, that's cool, but
yeah,
they're over in the blink of an eye kind of thing, right?
And it squanders, like, to wrap it up, even if they didn't want to go straight out into the gore, they have this big world that they found, like this hidden world where the Meg lives, but there's also where giant squids are and where other things, new species are discovered. It's like you could have spent a couple of hours just in that area
mm-hmm.
and have it like a sea monsters kind of thing where, again, this is also based on a book, so that maybe not be a direction from the book too, but
it'd be interesting. Have you read the book?
No.
Because I heard good things about the book, so well, I'm sure it probably wasn't totally faithful to the book in this.
Yeah. Yeah. So you could be right, but I mean, Jaws also wasn't faithful to the book.
Yeah.
We are going to wrap it up there. You can listen to this episode and other past episodes of the show on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can find us on social media at End Credits Radio Show on Facebook and End Credits Radio on Twitter. And Tim, where can people find you on the internet since they can't find you in the theater anymore?
I'm flashing the deadpan. During the Fringe run, we set up an Instagram page, so that's a really good place to find us. Flashing the Deadpan on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And yeah, the Fringe run went really well. The Joy of Sax was a lot of fun, and it harkens back to a lot of what we were talking about for Midnight Madness, really over-the-top comedy. So we posted a video of our last performance online, so if you want to see that. And maybe in the future we'll do a variation on on the theme of gentleman who plays the saxophone and makes people orgasm, which was the topic.
should mount a production in Guelph, yeah. Guelph Little Theater.
Yeah, we should.
Yeah. Well,
if you're listening, Guelph Little
Theater. Yeah, they listen every week.
Okay.
I'll be back here tomorrow at 5 p.m. for News and Politics and Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. And you can find me in the meantime on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca. And you can stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we'll be back here next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more End Credits. And we will see you then.